Our scripture reading this morning takes us to the Gospel of Matthew, where we're going to take up a reading in chapter 4 at verse 23. If you are using one of our turquoise-colored Bibles, you'll find this on page 968. Matthew chapter 4, verse 23. We're going to read into chapter 5, verse 16. And Michael, one of our elders, is going to come and read these words for us.
Matthew chapter 4, verse 23. Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and illness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and people brought to him all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, those and the paralyzed, and he healed them. Large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan followed him. Now, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." Amen.
Let me invite you to open your Bibles. Matthew chapter 5, the first few verses of Matthew 5 is where we're going to be thinking this evening. For the second time in one day, let me begin with a question. Whose approval counts most in your life? Whose approval counts most in your life? Is it the popular person in your class, in your group, in your workplace? Is that the person whose opinion really and whose approval really kind of matters for you? You don't want to do anything that they might disapprove because that's a big thing. Or maybe it's your employer. Maybe it's your boss. And his or her approval, well, that's significant because, you know, your employment prospects and all that stuff. Maybe the approval that is most for you is actually a little bit kind of closer to the heart, maybe. Maybe it's a boyfriend or girlfriend and their approval. That, more than anything else, is what drives you. Or maybe it's actually on the home front. Maybe it's the approval of a family member who always seems to struggle to give you their seal of approval. Maybe it's a spouse. Maybe their approval means maybe life's going to be easier for you. Who knows? But whose approval counts most in your life? I want to float the idea to you this evening that seeing this universe belongs to God, then having God's blessing on us, having his approval, really is in a category all of its own. I'm not saying that the approval of some of these other scenarios that I've tried to speak about, I'm not saying they're unimportant. They are. They are important, but they're not on the same level of importance, are they, of the creator of the universe? Because having God's approval, having God's blessing on your life really ought to be more important than the loving approval of a loved one, even when they are delightful, or the approval of somebody who may be very influential. Having the approval of God is in a totally different level. And so you may ask, well, therefore, who does have the approval of God? And that's one of the things that we're going to learn in these opening verses of the Sermon on the Mount, because the people that God and God's approval rests on are not the philanthropists of this world. It's not the charity gurus. It's not the powerful, the influential. It's not the movers and shakers. That's not the people upon whom God's approval rests. Actually, the people God's approval rests on would be people others in our generation might just ignore or reject. Because if you go through this list, well, you've got those who are meek. You've got those who are merciful. You've got those who are persecuted. They have this sense of blessing, this sense of God's approval over their lives. So if we wanted a reminder, maybe you didn't, but you're getting it anyway, but if you want a reminder about the standards of this world being very different to the standards of God, think about the people whom this world approves of and the people whom God's approval rests. And we will see that they are in two very different categories entirely. So, verses 3 to verse 10, which is what we're going to try and unpick over the next number of sessions that we're together on a Sunday evening, we're going to actually be trying to ask the question, well, who does God's approval rest upon? And we're going to learn that these answers are very, very different to what we might ordinarily think. And these answers are the way in which Jesus decides to begin this most famous sermon that's probably ever been preached. Certainly the title, Sermon on the Mount, is reasonably well known. The contents won't be, but the title is reasonably well known. But this is a sermon that Jesus has delivered to his disciples. He has begun in chapter 4, verse 17, preaching and saying, the kingdom of heaven is near. And then when we picked up our reading in verse 23, it's there talking about Jesus went out Galilee, teaching in the synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom. And now he's speaking to us about what life within the kingdom where he rules as king is actually going to be. What it's going to be like. He's telling us here, and so he says to us, to begin with, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. He's speaking, therefore, about this theme, the kingdom, where he reigns as king. The kingdom that he has inaugurated, the kingdom that he is giving glimpses of what it's going to be like, how very different. When he goes through, as it says in verse 23, when he's healing every disease and sickness, giving glimpses of what his kingdom rule is going to be like. And now he's telling his people what living as part of his kingdom will be. And so, Before actually we go any further, we need to pull into a lay-by, and we need to imagine a time or a location in the country where sat-nav doesn't work and Apple Maps don't work or Google Maps don't work because of various different coverage issues, and you've been given directions. You know, the way it used to be, and you'd be going along the road and you'll be by the third lamppost on the left-hand side. If you take a turn at that point, you carry on this road and there's different landmarks. Well, there's certain landmarks we need to have in our minds as we think about this message, this overall message of the Sermon on the Mount, and particularly as we zoom in on verse 3 this evening. There's a few things we need to keep clear. Number one, Jesus has not got an unrealistic, rosy view of this world. So when Jesus goes on about blessed are the poor in spirit and blessed are those who mourn and blessed are the merciful, Jesus did not wander through his time on earth where everything was just so ordered, so correct, so clean, so almost perfect that he's developed this outlook. Jesus knows very well that in a broken world, the meek don't inherit what they should. He knows that in a broken world, those who mourn don't always get the comfort that they deserve. Jesus knows that in this world, many people will go to their graves without experiencing or receiving the justice that they really ought to receive. Jesus knows these things. He doesn't have this unrealistic expectation of this life. He's lived in this broken world. He knows what it's like. And so when he is speaking and using descriptors that we may think, well, that's not the world I live in, we need to bear in mind that what Jesus is doing here is that he's speaking of spiritual truths. And these spiritual truths are what are to define the people of God. Second thing we need to bear in mind is we have, beginning in verse 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, the word blessed. Occasionally, some people will translate that happy. And happy doesn't quite do it in the sense that, you know, happiness is a subjective state. You may be happy if this service finishes at 25 past 6. You may not. Happiness is subjective. The blessing that's spoken of here is not subjective, it's objective. This is fact. The blessedness, the approval of God is about facts here. So as we work through these various traits that Jesus speaks of here, we're not talking about feelings, we're talking about the objective facts of those who have God's approval resting over them. Landmark number 3 is this. The descriptors here of those who are members of the kingdom, who are part of the kingdom, living under the kingdom rule of Jesus, those who are following Jesus as king, as Lord, as their master, the descriptors of us as poor in spirit and mourning and meek and merciful, this is not for the elite, specially trained Christians. You know, who go away to some great boot camp and will be put through all manner of really tough challenges. And at the end of it, they are the elite. They are the ones that you would look to and say, well, they are in a league of their own. Well, that's not what we have here. Because the 8 or so characteristics that we have in these verse 3 to 10, these are the characteristics of God's people. Not the elite of God's people, but God's people. These are characteristics that you and I, if we're found in Jesus tonight, that we will have and that we will exhibit. So it's not that this is for a special forces element. This is for every one of God's people. And so it is therefore, you don't need me to highlight this, landmark number 4, it is therefore, in this light of what I said, that Jesus is speaking about spiritual matters, and this is talking about the way Christians who are seeking to live under the rule of King Jesus will operate, we are being reminded the Sermon on the Mount is a message for those who are in Jesus Christ. Do you love Jesus tonight? Are you seeking to serve Jesus tonight? Well, this is a message for you. You see, it's not that we listen to the Sermon on the Mount and therefore we become a Christian. That doesn't work. It is we come to know Jesus and then we see how Jesus wants us to live in the Sermon on the Mount. And so the descriptions in these, the opening part of this sermon that he gives is basically, this is who we are. And then it'll go on through the rest of the sermon. This is how we ought to live. This is who we are, and this is how we ought to live. So who are we? First of all, we are those who are poor in spirit. Don't forget these last two words. Jesus is not extolling the virtues of poverty. Jesus lived a life of poverty that you and I can barely enter into. He lived a life where his wardrobe consisted of what he wore. He mentioned the fact that at times he didn't have a place to lay his head. Like everyone in that generation, the struggle to survive was a daily struggle. So Jesus knew what poverty was like. And it's not as if in our generation where rich people, you know, they go for the benefit of the TV and whatever else, they go from their rich life to, you know, live life in a scheme somewhere to understand what it might be like for other people, then only just to go back to how it was before, just to have a little taste of what poverty is like. Jesus knew poverty. Jesus is not extolling the virtues, how wonderful it is to be poor. He's not talking about material wealth. When he talks about being poor in spirit, he's not talking about material wealth. He is also not talking about our outlook. He's not talking about being particularly negative, having a very low self-esteem. That's not what he's speaking of at all. He is speaking of the people who have God's approval are those who know that they are spiritually poor. In fact, they are those who know that they are spiritually bankrupt in the sense that we have nothing that we have by ourselves individually or collectively to offer to God that would somehow merit us receiving the mercy or the grace of God. We just don't have it. We are spiritually destitute. One person described it as spiritual no-hopers. We see the standard God has set. We see where we are. We see the big gulf that exists between the standard set and where we are. And we realize, well, I can't get there. I have no capability to be able to get from here to here. I've got nothing. And all I can do is therefore throw myself on the mercy of God. All I do is bang on the windows, bang on the door on the outside and plead for mercy, plead for something that I might be taken on the inside in that sense. Jesus told a story one day about two people who went to pray. And one guy, who was very religious and he was very upstanding, would pray, and effectively he prayed to himself, didn't he? I thank you that I'm not like other people. I do this and I do that. I do the next thing. I thank you, I'm not like this person. And the person was a publican, obviously condemned by religious people. And the publican, in Jesus' story, says, he couldn't even lift his head up. He just beat his breast. And he's going, Lord, have mercy upon me, a sinner. He had nothing. Jesus said, which one went home in the right frame, accepted before God? Well, it's the one who came recognizing their condition and pleading for mercy. Because spiritually, he didn't have anything to offer. In the same way, we don't have anything to offer. A couple of weeks ago, just entered year 20 of being a preacher. And in that 20 years, I've never totaled up how many funerals I've done. I do far less actually here than on the West Coast. On the West Coast, there were an awful lot of funerals. I have never once buried anyone or been part of a cremation service where the family didn't think that their loved one was headed for heaven. Didn't matter how much of a scoundrel the individual may or may not have been. They would always find something about the individual that would somehow merit their being accepted by God. Well, he was far better than his brother, or whatever it might be. And the reality is, it's a distortion, isn't it? It's a lie. Because none of us, no matter how pleasant our personalities, no matter how generous we might be with our time and with our affection, let alone with our finances, none of that is going to cut it before God. None of it's going to cut before God. We cannot stand before a perfect God the way we are. And this idea of being poor in spirit is helping us to realize that actually we had nothing. We were nothing. And what we are now is everything to do with God. Because of his mercy and grace towards helpless, spiritually bankrupt people like me, then there is this promise. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And so what does this require of us? This first statement of Jesus, blessed are the poor in spirit, it requires us to be honest. To be honest about ourselves. You see, it's not our responsibility to look at others and say, well, that person's like, there's no chance for that person regarding God because of this, that, and the next thing. We don't have to look anywhere apart from ourselves. And if we're honest with ourselves, if we're honest about ourselves, then we will recognize that we had nothing spiritually whatsoever to offer to God. And yet, God's approval can rest on us. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Then goes on, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So there's spiritual poverty that leads to kingdom possession. And a kingdom needs a king, and a king needs subjects, and subjects that King Jesus has are not those who have been somehow dragooned into his service against their will. You remember the stories of some of our Highland history when various different government bands would go to communities and literally dragoon people into serving in the forces. Oh, there's none of that with King Jesus. King Jesus has the happiest subjects. He has subjects who delight in their king. Because the subjects of King Jesus, I mean, treason doesn't come anywhere near our thinking because we can't imagine a king more precious, a king more devoted, a king more true, more pure, more wise than King Jesus. And so we willingly participate, we delight in the reign of Jesus as our king. And if our king asks us to do something, well, we do it. If our king asks us to do something that's difficult, we know he's going to give us the help to be able to fulfill that. And if our king, at times, he may ask us to do things that maybe we don't even want to do, but we know our king has our best interest at heart. And so as subjects of the king, well, We want to live. We want to delight in him and in his rule. And so as a consequence of being part of his kingdom, having been brought in because we saw how spiritually bankrupt we were, and we came and we pled for his mercy, he welcomed us into to himself. He welcomed us into his kingdom. And therefore, as a consequence, not as a reward, we don't earn the kingdom of heaven. As a consequence of being a subject of King Jesus, then the kingdom of heaven becomes ours. And you say, ho ho, add on, becomes ours. Surely the kingdom of heaven, it belongs to God. And that's true. It does belong to God. But there's a distinct way in which these words say to us that we, as joint heirs with Christ, that we also have some connection, some ownership connection of the kingdom of heaven. And you're going, well, that's almost beyond description. Those of us who are spiritually bankrupt, not simply by nature, but by practice, we could have some locus in the kingdom of heaven? Yes, that is exactly what you are if you are found in Jesus Christ tonight. That is exactly what you possess as one of the people of God. So what does this mean? Well, it impacts how we view ourselves, doesn't it? I was reading the other day a new biography of Billy Graham. Younger ones in here won't know who Billy Graham is. Billy Graham was an American preacher who spoke personally to 215 million people, telling them of the gospel of Jesus Christ. For many, it was the first time that they began to understand what the message of the gospel was about. 215 million people, over 400 rallies, put it in a bit of context. Taylor Swift's last tour, there was 3 million people went along to it. Spent an awful lot of money to go along to it. But 215 million people Billy Graham preached to. In the headquarters, whereby the organization that would plan the various places that he would go and preach, they'd done a revamp one day. And there was a little bit about the history of the organization, and they invited Billy to have a wander around. And he's seen all these various different facts and figures, and he's seen photos, and he's not seen anything. And eventually, one of the people said to him, well, tell me what you think. And he said, well, what I think is that there's too much of Billy Graham and not enough of Jesus Christ. What a fabulous answer. There's too much of Billy Graham, but there's not enough of Jesus Christ. And so here's a guy who was, he had the ear of presidents, pop stars of the day, actors, whatever. And yet he knew that himself, he's nothing apart from Jesus. Because being poor in spirit is not an area that we veer into in order to experience the converting work of God. And then we graduate from it onto a different level. No. Being poor in spirit is where we remain. We remain recognizing what we are by nature before God, and amazed at what we are by grace before God. So therefore, what might this look like for us tonight? Well, one writer put it this way. If you were going to list a number of areas in your life that you thought you needed to develop spiritually, would the eight characteristics that are listed here, verse 3 to 10, would they register on that list? So, would we have on that list, well, if I need to develop spiritually, well, poverty of spirit, meekness, merciful, being persecuted, would they be on the list? Well, it's the case, because the Bible tells us, that churches can very easily forget what we're meant to be before God. Let me tell you of a church that's mentioned in the Bible. It's a church in a place called Laodicea. And in the book of Revelation in chapter 3, you will find the account of what takes place in Laodicea. And in these churches, very interestingly, we have, because there's seven churches mentioned, we have the fact that Jesus is the one who wanders around these churches. He knows exactly what's going on in these churches, just like he knows exactly what's going on in our congregation. And the people in Laodicea say this. This is Jesus quoting their words. You say, I am rich. I have acquired wealth and do not need a thing. But you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire so you can become rich, and white clothes to wear so you can cover your shameful nakedness, and salve to put on your eyes so that you can see. You see, as far as they were concerned, they'd made it. They'd had the resources that they needed in life, the resources they needed as a congregation, they'd made it. And their view of themselves was really very blinkered. And their view of themselves was actually very dangerous, because Jesus' view of them was very different. And they thought they had it, but they didn't. And they're probably very opinionated about how they got to the place that they got to, but that wasn't wise. And so we need to be very careful individually, collectively, that we never progress from being poor in spirit. But maybe you have not yet begun that path of faith. And for you, maybe recognizing what it is to be poor in spirit, let me take you to another part of the Bible. Let me take you to a story Jesus told of a guy who decided he had enough at home. He wanted out of the restraints that he had at home, out of the routines. He comes to his dad and he said, listen, you're going to die at some point. What you would have given me then, give me now, because I'm out here. Disrespecting his father in a remarkable way in that culture. So he goes and he leaves and he's all so proud and he's got loads of pals. He's got loads of parties to go to, doesn't he? Life is just superb, just exactly the way he wanted until the money runs out. And then the mates leave and then the party invites go. And then bit by bit, he's brought to a position where he realizes he has nothing. Nothing at all. And he thinks of his father. And he says, I know what I'll do. I'm going to go back and I'm going to tell him I am not worthy to be called a son anymore. Make me like a servant. I'll serve you. I'm not a son. What happened to him? He realized literally, physically, and yet above all spiritually, that he was empty. He was bankrupt. What did he find? Well, when he went to the Father, whom Jesus describes in the story as the God figure, he doesn't find the Father standing there with his arm closed, turning away, pointing, shouting, telling him to beat it. He finds the Father running towards him. You see, if today, tonight, right now, you begin to realize that you are actually spiritually bankrupt, and you think, what do I do? Well, you run to the Father, and you will find arms open. Welcome to receive you. Because here's the thing. I don't know how you answered the question when we began. Whose opinion counts most? Whose approval do you seek? It's God's approval. God's opinion that will matter for your present, for your future, forever. Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.